symposium, which is entitled The Future of Microbicides, From Vaginal Art to PrEP. I'll be sharing my chairman's duties with Dr. Namita Chandiok from India. I think this is a very important meeting because it really underlines the evolution of the microbicide and the PrEP fields. At one time, perhaps, they could have been seen as disparate areas of prevention research, but it's becoming increasingly apparent that both areas of research actually have a level of confluence. Essentially, we're giving either topical ART, PrEP, in the sense of microbicides, or oral PrEP. And a number of centers and groups are now beginning to explore in some detail the differential pharmacokinetics of delivering these drugs by either route. And indeed, the United States-sponsored microbicide trial network, in their VOICE study, which is vaginal and oral interventions to control the epidemic, will have the opportunity to directly compare oral PrEP with a vaginal topical PrEP. And so I think this is going to be a very interesting area. And I think the speakers who we have to educate us this afternoon will give you a very informative perspective of how the PrEP landscape is evolving. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, who's Dr. Guido Van Ham from Leuven, Belgium. He studied medicine there, but has spent much of his career in HIV research at the Institute of Tropical Medicine. And he'll be telling us about future promising microbicidal products, what we can learn from the in vitro studies. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. Well, first let me thank you for the invitation to be here at this very nice symposium. So for those who are not familiar with the field, I give a brief introduction, and then we go into some real data that show, in fact, that probably from in vitro models you can already predict to some extent the success or failure of future microbicides. And at the end, I will give some issues, some questions, and some perspectives. So we concentrate on vaginal HIV transmission, and a first important point is that we still do not know whether the virus is transmitted as a cell-free or as a cell-associated virus. Then somehow the virus gets over the epithelial layer, and it is controversial whether the Langerhans cells play a role in that event. But they make their way somehow to the sub-epithelial layer and then can infect local macrophages, T cells, but most importantly also interstitial dendritic cells. And these cells tend to cluster with T cells and then become migratory clusters that will move into the regional lymph nodes and there really start the systemic infection. So this event, the migration of clusters of dendritic cells and T cells, is a very crucial early event. Now, the viral cycle is, of course, familiar to most of you, but to be really preventive, of course, what you need is prevention, finally, of cellular integration of proviral DNA. And you can act at several points. You can either disrupt the virus or create conditions in the vagina that inhibit the virus or kill the virus. You can interfere with the entry process, with the fusion process, with the reverse transcriptase, or with the integrase. And potential microbicide, candidate microbicides, have been developed in all these classes. To keep the pH of the vagina low and hostile to the virus, some buffer gels and acid form have been developed and are in clinical trials still. There are the classical viral disruptors, such as nonoxynol 9, which appeared to be obsolete because of inducing of inflammation and damage to the epithelium. And then a vast class of non-specific binding inhibitors has been or is still in trial. They are mainly polyanions, and I cite here cellulose sulfate, Cargard, Pro 2000, and Vivagel. So most of these products have already failed, and some are still in phase 3 trial. Now then we enter the more specific stages of the viral cycle, the inhibition of the binding of CD4 to GP120, and there are some small molecular compounds that have been developed, for instance by Bristol-Myers Squibb. You can interfere with the binding to CCR5, and I give just some examples. Maraviroc is the best known. Or you can inhibit, in the case of dendritic cells, with the binding to dendritic cells via DC-SIGN. Then you have fusion inhibitors. You have reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And those, of course, are the newer products that are going in, that are progressing into clinical trials. You can either have the nucleotide, and or the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And amongst the nucleoside, you have Truvada, which is a combination product. Amongst the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, there is TMC-120 and UC-781, belonging to two different chemical classes of NNRTI. And finally, the integrase inhibitors. For instance, I will show you some data on L870-812, which is an analog of raltegravir. And some people argue that protease inhibitors could also be used in combination to prevent systemic infection. Now, the clinical research process is a long process. It starts with the in vitro activity and toxicity evaluation, then it goes over animal models, and finally comes into human clinical trial. Now, in the case of microbicides, certainly this process could take 10 years or more. Now, focusing on the in vitro models, there is a large number of in vitro models to test HIV microbicides, going from very simple cell lines that express CD4 and CCR5, such as the ghost cell, U87 and the TMZBL, which are very simple to use, rapid screening. You can use infectious but non-replicative viruses, such that you don't need an L3 environment. But the main disadvantage is that these cells are by no way representative of the in vivo primary target cells. But it is very useful to screen large numbers of microbicides or potential microbicides in the first phase. Now, the second more realistic model is mitogen-activated PBMC. This is a very standardized system. It is relatively quick and easy, but you look only at activated T cells, and those are not the cells that transmit the virus from the vagina to the systemic, to the lymph nodes. Therefore, we and others have developed a co-culture system of dendritic cells and T-cells, which is more representative of the crucial early stage of HIV transmission, but which is also more complex and time-consuming. So you need some pre-screening, because otherwise you end up with an impossible task. As you will see later, screening in this system takes a month. An increasing complexity and increasing relevance comes when you combine dendritic cell T-cell co-cultures with an epithelial cell layer. And finally, of course, the most representative system is an explant model. But it has also some limitations. There is limited access because it has to come from therapeutic hysterectomies. The cells or the tissue is limited in viability, and the different components have a different degree of viability, and it is never really intact. So it represents a kind of worst-case scenario, but it is certainly very useful. Now, I will show you some data on simple in vitro systems and indicate that, in fact, there you can clearly see differences between microbicides or candidate microbicides that at first view are very similar. So we used the host cell system as screening, then the dendritic cell T-cell co-culture system, and then went on to this dual chamber system, which includes an epithelial cell layer, and I will also show you results on the explant model, but then results from another group, because we have not done this ourselves. Now, in the pseudovirus test with the cell lines, it's very simple. You incubate the pseudovirus, or the single cycle pseudovirus, with the microbicide, and you put on the cells, and you let it go for 48 hours. And these pseudoviruses are manipulated in such a way that they express that they integrate into the DNA, and then express luciferase, so they have a luciferase gene, and so you can just look at the production of light as evidence of presence or absence of the virus. And now I show you some results of different classes of molecules, the inhibitors of the CD4 binding, which is the BMS compound, inhibitor of CCR5, the fusion inhibitor T20, the PMPA, TMC120, UC781, and then the integrase inhibitor. And as you can see in this system, all these products are highly potent with EC50 values below 100 nanomolar. Now we go for a more complicated system, the co-culture model, of dendritic cells and T4 cells. In this system, you can use either cell-free replication-competent virus or cell-associated virus. You incubate it with your compound, you add the dendritic cells, and afterwards you add the T cells, and then you let it go for 2 weeks, and you can have an additional expansion step to reveal latent infection. Now, this is the result if you compare the data from the pseudovirus test I just showed you with those in dendritic cell T cells. As you can see, the binding and fusion inhibitors, which were very potent in the cell line, are less potent when you use primary virus and primary cells, and primary cell-free virus in this case. But when you use cell-associated virus, these very potent compounds show hardly any activity. In contrast, the various reverse transcriptase inhibitors, in this case PMPA and the non-nucleosides, they maintain the same level of activity regardless whether you work with a primary virus or a pseudovirus, whether you work with cell-associated or cell-free HIV. And the integrase inhibitor in this case shows a kind of intermediary profile, so it keeps activity, but it loses some activity as compared with the pseudovirus system. Now we complicate and make the system probably a little bit more relevant by adding an epithelial cell layer on top of the co-culture of dendritic cells and T cells. And in our experiments that I will show you, we used cell-associated virus on top of the epithelial cell layer. Now, in this experiment, I show you some results of anti-inhibitors, but those are the anti-inhibitors that have been or are still in clinical trial, the Pro-2000 and cellulose sulfate and some related products. And then here, a bunch of non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And the difference is quite striking. In this system with cell-associated virus, all these four anti-inhibitors had no antiviral activity whatsoever, up to a concentration of 100 micrograms per milliliter, whereas all the NNRTI were highly potent. Now let's move to the explant model. Now the explant model contains entire cervical vaginal tissue, mostly taken from the cervix. But as in vivo, after a few days or even after 1 day, the dendritic cells and T cells start to move out of this system. And you can recuperate them and measure antiretroviral activity in these cells separately from the entire tissue. So in the next results, there will be two kinds of results, the inhibition on the cervical epithelium as a whole and the inhibition on the migratory cells below. And so those are data from Robin Shattuck's lab. In this column, you see the effect of UC781, the NNRTI, which shows, so this is the control, these are the different concentrations of UC781. It shows some inhibition in this example against the entire intact epithelium, but the inhibition is much more pronounced against when you look into the migratory cells. In contrast, various binding inhibitors were used here, and I won't name them all because they were specific for the various processes, for CD4, for DC-sign, for CCR5. And as you can see, they show quite a good inhibition in the entire epithelium, but when you look at the migratory cells, the degree of inhibition is much less. So which is consistent with the previous data in the more simple cellular or cell suspension systems. Now, what are the issues in further development of microbicides? First of all, unfortunately, a quarter of a century into the epidemic, very essential questions about transmission are still not resolved. Is it cell-free or cell-associated virus that is being transmitted? And as I showed you from the results of various microbicides, this is a very important question because some microbicides active against cell-free virus are not or less active against cell-associated virus. We don't know which are the most relevant target cells and most relevant receptors to look at. The role of seminal plasma and cervicovaginal fluid factors has been studied, but with variable results. Sometimes you find inhibition, sometimes you find enhancement. And there is certainly a role of the normal vaginal flora, of pathological bacteria, and what I call vaginal practices, like vaginal hygiene measures that women take. So we have to take into account all these unknown factors to some extent and build them into our systems to have a reliable model. And then the second series of issues is that, of course, we absolutely want to avoid unwanted side effects. And those are not only the enhancement of infection by epithelial damage or inflammation, but also we should not limit future therapeutic options by induction of resistance, cross-resistance against therapeutically used drugs. Now, to conclude, which is the in vitro test that is most suitable and most predictive? Well, of course, it is impossible to say today because you need a golden standard, and the only possible golden standard is a successful phase 3 clinical trial. Until now, we don't have that. But in the meantime, we have to address as many as possible of the issues that I just named. And so our models have to reflect aspects of sexual transmission faithfully. So I think dendritic cells and T cells, together, of course, with epithelial cells, should always be taken into account. The explant model is, of course, very important, and we should include seminal and vaginal fluid factors when we test microbicides in vitro. In addition, it is very important that we assure that there is activity not only against cell-free virus, but also cell-associated virus. And now more and more that we study optimal drug combinations, because it's evident that there is synergism between the different classes of drugs, but the degree of synergism can be very different. We should do a thorough evaluation of toxicity, and we should already in vitro study the consequences of possible resistance induction. Well, this is the acknowledgement slide with my collaborators and all the funding that was available for the data that I showed you and the many data that I didn't show you. Thank you.
A very good afternoon to all of you, and thank you, Guido, for a very informative talk. We need an increasing pipeline of candidate microbicide products. And we also know that it's really the preclinical evaluation of these products which would determine which of these candidates would go into clinical trials. And as you mentioned, at this point, we really don't know which test would be the most predictive. We will be taking questions at the end of the session, and we will be using the question card for that. So if anybody would like to ask a question, please raise your hand, and a card would be given to you in which the question could be written, and that would be sent, given to the speakers, and they would respond to that at the end of the session. It is my great pleasure now to introduce the next speaker, Dr. Saleem Abdul Kareem, better known as Slim to all of us, who is an infectious disease epidemiologist and pro-vice chancellor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. He is director of CAPRISA, professor in clinical epidemiology at Columbia University, and adjunct professor of medicine at Cornell University. He is the chair of the WHO Scientific and Technical Advisory Group for Reproductive Health, and also an executive member of the NIH-funded Microbicides Trial Network, and member of the Gates Foundation Global HIV Prevention Working Group. And all of us know all the sterling work which Slim and his group have been doing for many years.
Thank you very much, Namita. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to do this presentation. What I hope to do in the next 15 minutes or so is just to share with you the status of the antiretroviral microbicides that are currently in the field. And what I want to do is I'll just briefly touch on the issue of, is there still a need for microbicide? And I assume most of you are here because you've already answered that question, so probably very rhetorical in this audience. And then I'll touch on some of the past and current microbicide trials before going into the antiretroviral microbicides that are in clinical and preclinical development, and before ending off touching on some of the challenges within these trials. So just for those of you not totally familiar with the field, a microbicide is a product that can be applied to the vagina or rectal mucosa with the intention of preventing the transmission of sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. And they come in many different formulations. In fact, in the past, there used to be foams and sponges and so on. But now, more or less, it's sort of the field has coned down to a few of those formulations, and mostly the formulations that are currently being studied are gels, vaginal rings, and foams. And I want to just say that microbicides that contain antiretroviral drugs are essentially just a different formulation of pre-exposure prophylaxis. So they're just a different way of providing PrEP. So whether we provide antiretrovirals to newborn children to prevent mother-to-child transmission, or whether we provide antiretrovirals orally in tablet form to IDUs to prevent them from getting infected, all of these are basically the same principle. And what I will be focusing on in this talk is just one formulation of PrEP, and that is the topical formulations. So is there still a need for microbicides? Well, I'm sharing with you these data, which are data on the HIV prevalence in South Africa. And I want you to firstly focus on the blue line. So if you look at the blue line, that's the prevalence of HIV infection in men. And if you look at the age group, 10 to 14 years, you can see that HIV prevalence in young boys is very low. If you go further on to the HIV prevalence in the 15 to 19 year age group, similarly, it's low. And it's only when you start getting into the mid-20s to the late 20s that you see the prevalence of HIV infection in men rising quite rapidly. However, the situation is very different as far as women are concerned, or females. And if we look here at young girls, 10 to 14, and this comes from a community-based survey in South Africa, you can see the prevalence is very low. However, when you start looking at teenage girls, you are seeing the rapid rise of infection. And in fact, teenage girls in South Africa have prevalence rates of HIV infection that are close to the peak. So by the time you get to women in their early 20s, you're looking at very high rates of HIV infection. And indeed, it is this difference in the age group between men and women that results in such a rapid epidemic in Southern Africa. And it's shown here when you look at the way in which the HIV epidemic has grown in southern Africa from being almost non-existent in the late 1980s to a rapid rise in the early 1990s to a current plateauing that we are seeing in South Africa. But it's the young girls, it's the teenage girls, the women in their early 20s that's driving this very high prevalence in pregnant women that we see in South Africa. And there's no question that this group, for us to have any success in controlling the HIV epidemic in the context of southern Africa, to avoid this kind of rapid rise in prevalence, we have to find some way to empower these young girls and these young women to prevent HIV infection. And this was probably best captured in a paper that was published in the early 1990s by Zena Stein in the American Journal of Public Health, which raised this issue about HIV prevention, the need for methods that women can use and control. And in fact, since then, the concept of microbicides has gelled, pardon the pun, and what we've seen since then is a range of different microbicide trials. So let me just explain the color coding that I've used. When I've used red, that's to indicate that the trial showed that there was an increase in HIV infection in the active arm. In other words, the product was associated with an increased risk or increased susceptibility of HIV infection among those who used it. When I've used green, that means the study was done and showed that the product was safe. And when I show yellow, it means that the study was stopped for futility. And as they stopped the study early because they couldn't show a definitive result one way or the other. So if we look at the early studies of the first class of products of surfactants, what we see is that the studies done in Kenya and the multi-country study undertaken by WHO UNAIDS of the Col 1492, a formulation of nanoxonal 9, both showed increased risk of HIV infection among those who used the product. On the other hand, the N9 film study that was done in Cameroon by FHI did not show any difference between the two study arms. The FHI Savvy study was stopped for futility. So we've moved now beyond this class of products, and nobody is continuing to study these products in humans any longer. And currently, what we are seeing are the results of the next class of products, the polymers that are emerging. So what we've had so far is we've had the results of the Conrad cellulose sulfate study that were released, which showed, one of those trials showed, the Conrad trial showed, that there was an increased risk of HIV infection among those who used cellulose sulfate. And those results are published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine. There was a parallel study that was being undertaken by FHI, which was stopped for futility. It did not show harm. The Population Council also recently released their results of Carrigard, which showed that the product was safe but did not show any efficacy. And then more recently, you might have heard that the British MRC, in conducting the study in their microbicides development program, dropped one of their arms for futility, and that was the 2% Pro-2000. So currently in trials in this class, we have Pro-2000, 0.5%, and buffer gel that are being studied. And then if we look at the class of products that I'll be talking about, focusing on in this presentation, it's the antiretrovirals. And here we have the Caprisa tenofovir gel trial. We have the MTN, which is a crossover trial, which brings together the gel formulations and the oral formulations and combinations, as well as single agents. And then we have the IPM, also a trial which looks at different formulations, both rings and gels. So where are we with each of these products? And I'm just going to very briefly touch on these because Zira Rosenberg, in her presentation earlier this week, covered much of this. So I'll just go through this quite quickly. So tenofovir gel is a nucleotide reverse transcriptase inhibitor. It was developed by Gilead Sciences and is currently licensed to both Conrad and IPM for further development as the gel formulation. It's effective and it's licensed as a therapeutic drug, and in fact is very widely used in therapy. It's got a very good safety profile and has a very long half-life, and it shows protection in multiple animal challenge studies. and it's got a high barrier for drug resistance. And so that's what makes it a particularly good drug to study for prophylaxis, whether in gel formulation or in oral formulation. So why use the gel formulation? Why don't we just stay with studying tablets? I'm going to share with you data that comes from CONRAD, which looks at the levels of the drug in the different formulations. So if we look at the tablet formulation, so taking tenofovir as a tablet, at 10 to the 2 is the level that's achieved in blood, in plasma. And you can see that over time, that level is pretty static, just illustrating the long half-life of this drug in plasma. If you take the tablet, what happens? What do we see in the genital tract? And so cervical-vaginal washings from patients who've taken the oral form of tenofovir, taken tenofovir tablets, show that the levels in the vagina are fairly similar to that you see in the plasma. They're just slightly higher at all the time points. However, when we look at the gel formulation, we look at vaginal tissues, and these are levels of the drug within the tissues that are studied through taking biopsies at differing time points, what we see is that the levels are substantially higher. We've now gone from levels that were 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 5. And so we're seeing much higher levels of tenofovir within the vaginal tissue, and again, they have a long half-life. What we see in the vaginal, cervical-vaginal washings, again, is very high levels, but that's what you would expect given that you've inserted the gel. The key is, so what happens with the gel formulation? How much of that gets into the blood? How much of it gets systemically absorbed? And what we've seen is that somewhere between a quarter to a third of the women have detectable levels of the drug in plasma when inserted as a gel. So these are the gel formulations inserted in the vagina and looking at levels of the drug in blood. And what we see is very low levels of the drug and then again this long tail that you see with tenofovir. So what we're seeing is that very little of tenofovir gets absorbed systemically when administered as a gel formulation. So what we're seeing are two very different distributions of the drug, whether you take it orally or whether you take it in the gel formulation in the vagina. So what has happened with tenofovir? Where are we with its in its clinical development pathway? I thought I would just include this just to make the point that tenofovir was first shown to protect in a macaque challenge study in 1995. And it took us all of 11 years before we got it entering into a human trial for efficacy. Well, by 2006, we had already more than 20 macaque challenge studies with tenofovir. And in fact, every week I hear about a new trial that's being done with tenofovir or with tenofovir combined with FTC. Well, since the beginning of 2006, in fact, in late 2005, we had the HPTN that started studying tenofovir, doing a phase 1 safety study in PK that was led by Ken Mayer. We've subsequently had a phase 2 study of differing dosing strategies led by Sharon Hillier that was done in India and the United States. We've had the data that have just emerged from the male tolerance study that was undertaken by CONRAD, and then the CONRAD gel PK study, which is the data I just shared with you, was completed earlier this year and presented at the Microbicides 2008 conference in New Delhi. And then in 2007, we had the first of the tenofovir gel efficacy trials that was initiated, and that trial is expected to be completed somewhere in 2010. But it's not enough for us to just proceed with that. We have to look at a whole range of other issues relating to safety. And these are very specific issues in order to expand the use of tenofovir. And so the MTN initiated a phase 1 safety study in pregnancy and also a phase 1 study looking at the pharmacokinetics of both the gel and the tablet in the MTN-001 study led by Craig. And most recently, and I will be sharing a little bit more detail with you, the MTN voice study. So where are we with the current phase 2B tenofovir gel trial? Well, we've got the CAPRISE-004 trial, which is a randomized, double-blinded test of concept trial, and we have 845 participants enrolled. The retention at this point is 91%, and there's been good adherence to the gel. I think we've had some challenges within the studies in terms of co-enrollment, but we've reached about a quarter of the endpoints, and the study is still scheduled to be completed on time. Let me just spend a minute or so on the MTN voice trial, because it's a critical trial in that it compares two different formulations. So the voice trial is about vaginal and oral interventions. So it's looking at tenofovir and Truvada in oral formulation and tenofovir in the gel formulation. And the 4,200 participants that we anticipate enrolling in this study will be randomized into one of five arms, three of them taking oral formulation and two taking gel formulation. So people will be randomized to taking Truvada, which is a combination of tenofovir and FTC, and you'll hear more about that from Tim when he speaks next. Viread, which is the tenofovir oral formulation, placebo tablet, or they will be taking tenofovir or placebo gel. The next drug I want to touch on is dapivirine, which is TMC-120, which is a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, which is developed by Tibotec and licensed to IPM. It was initially developed as a therapeutic, and it's very potent as an antiretroviral. It's also got low toxicity, it's easily manufactured, and so it's a very appropriate drug to develop. It's also being developed by IPM as a combination with maraviroc. Its clinical pathway that we've seen to date is we've seen the gel PK study, the safety studies that were undertaken by IPM, the male tolerance studies, and then we've seen the ring development studies that have been initiated, and the ring safety and PK studies, leading to what is going to be the efficacy study, the phase 3 trial that is being developed by IPM as it stands. And just to touch on some aspects of their trial, it's an adaptive trial design with multiple arms comparing both the ring formulation and the gel formulation. There's a strong focus on safety within the trial. There'll be early looks for futility. It's a study being powered for licensure, and they're looking at many innovative strategies to improve adherence within the trial using smart applicators and, again, using ring formulations which only need to be inserted once a month. And they anticipate that this study will start somewhere in 2010. The third antiretroviral drug, which is in an advanced stage of clinical development, is UC781, which is licensed to Conrad. It's a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor with potent anti-HIV activity, again, low toxicity, and it's being developed by Conrad also as a combination with tenofovir. It's been through phase 1 safety studies, male tolerance studies, and vaginal PK studies and rectal studies, and is now proceeding along that pathway. I'm going to very quickly touch on MIV-150, which is licensed to the Population Council. They are developing it as a combination of MIV-150 with Carrigard, and they anticipate starting their phase 1 safety trials later this year or early next year. So this is just completing its preclinical studies and is entering into human trials. Maraviroc, which you've heard quite a bit about, a CCR5 inhibitor, is licensed to IPM and is being developed as a gel and as a ring, and is being developed as a combination product with dapivirine and maraviroc, and is currently in preclinical assessment. There are many other products and compounds in the pipeline by IPM. I'm not going to touch on them, and I want to just end by touching on very quickly some of the challenges in antiretroviral microbicide trials. You've heard already about the challenges of how do we select the best products and how do we select products to move forward, given that we don't have a validated animal model. And so we're using a whole range of different assays. We're using a range of different criteria in order to pull together a complete picture to identify those products which are most suitable to move forward. And we're learning that they are readily developing. There's a whole range of newly developing assays that are coming forward. One of those, which is interesting, is the ex vivo challenge model, where the gel is put into a human being and then a biopsy is taken, and then the biopsy tissue is challenged with HIV. So getting very, very much trying to simulate what would happen in the real world situation. We have no surrogate markers for safety or protection at this point. And so we have to look at endpoint as the only gold standard we have for safety and efficacy. We have many challenges in adherence. Any of you who've done a microbicide trial know this problem. And we know, for example, trying to achieve adherence over a long period is a major challenge. I mean, just look at what was achieved in the daily acyclovir study, where they had only 34.5% of the participants had detectable acyclovir at 12 months. The potential for drug resistance you've already heard about, and there are many design challenges which have been adequately covered in the IOM report, which I will not touch on. So just by way of concluding, there are three reverse transcriptase inhibitor antiretrovirals, tenofovir, dapivirine, and UC781, that are well along in the clinical development pathway. The first antiretroviral microbicide effectiveness trial is underway, and we have two further large effectiveness trials, the VOICE trial and the IPM trial, which we anticipate will start within the next 2 years. We have new formulations in the way of rings, and we have two other antiretrovirals that are also well along in terms of their preclinical development and will be entering pretty soon into human trials. And lastly, we've got many combinations that are being developed. You heard about UC781 and tenofovir. There's a whole range of combinations that are being developed. I'd like to end by just thanking the many people who contributed data to this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lim. I think we all agree that there is still a need for microbicides, and we've all moved to an era of antiretroviral-containing topical products. And the many challenges in this field have been highlighted by him. It's not an easy field. It's a learning process, and I think we've learned from every clinical trial that has been completed. We move to our next speaker, and I'd like to introduce Dr. Timothy Mastro, whose training is in internal medicine, epidemiology, and public health. He is Senior Director of Research at Family Health International and has worked on HIV prevention programs, science, clinical trials, and research at the US CDC for 20 years. His work has included clinical trials of antiretroviral agents for pre-exposure prophylaxis and the prevention of mother-to-child transmission, vaginal microbicides, and HIV vaccines. Dr. Mastro's training, as I said, is in this field, and we look forward to his presentation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for that introduction. It's really a privilege to be here today to present all these trials on behalf of the investigators and institutions doing them. There's a very strong rationale for the use of antiretrovirals for the prevention of HIV infection. ARVs are very effective in preventing mother-to-child transmission. They're effective for post-exposure prophylaxis for HIV, and there are very compelling animal models in macaques showing the prevention of a HIV-like transmission using antiretrovirals. The available ARVs we have appear to be safe. We have tens of thousands of person's years experience with these drugs, and the available ARVs we'll talk about today can be used once a day. All of the studies I'll be talking about today use really two chemicals and three formulations, tenofovir or TDF, the brand name Viriad, emtricitabine or FTC. When you combine these two drugs together, the brand name is Truvada, and all of these drugs are made by Gilead Sciences. These are data from Waleed Hanini's laboratory at the Centers for Disease Control, which shows some of the background work that really informed the human clinical trials. This is a multiple challenge, a rectal challenge model in macaques done at CDC, showing here that the control animals shown in red very quickly get infected after 14 weeks of challenge with a SHIV virus. Now, the higher the line, the more protection. So when you give oral tenofovir, you can protect some of the animals for a few weeks, but eventually 3 out of 4 get infected. If you use FTC subcutaneously, you do a little bit better. If you combine two drugs together orally, you do even better. And if you give high-dose FTC and tenofovir subcutaneously, you protect all 6 of these monkeys with 14 challenges, so perfect protection in this small sample of monkeys. There's been one completed human clinical trial to date. This is the FHI West Africa Phase 2 PrEP trial with support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. This is a randomized controlled trial of tenofovir 300 milligrams a day and placebo. Altogether, 936 women were enrolled in Ghana, Cameroon, and Nigeria. Only the Ghana site went to completion. The study was stopped early in Cameroon and Nigeria, conducted from 2004 through 2006. The positive outcomes of this study were that there was no evidence of increased clinical or laboratory adverse effects. There was no evidence of risk compensation, that is, women on study did not have an increase in risky behavior. However, there was inadequate power to assess the efficacy of this due to the smaller sample than intended. There were 8 infections in the trial, 2 in the tenofovir arm, 6 in the placebo arm, but due to the small numbers, this was not significant. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to summarize 7 trials. There are 5 ongoing trials, the 3 CDC trials, IPREX and partners, and there are 2 trials that are in planning that should be starting relatively soon, FHI's FemPrep trial and the VOICE trial from the MTN. Moving forward. The first CDC trial is a smaller extended safety trial of tenofovir to assess clinical, laboratory, and behavioral safety, adherence, and acceptability. Again, it's a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial with tenofovir daily versus placebo daily. Individuals are on study drug for 24 months with DSMB safety reviews every 6 months. Enrolled into this trial are 400 HIV-negative men who have sex with men in Atlanta, San Francisco, and Boston. To assess whether or not one's behavior changes prior to the time of initiating study drug, for 200 of the participants, they are enrolled for follow-up, but then they're not randomized for drug for 9 more months. So there's a run-in period of 9 months of observation of behavior to compare with behavior after they're on drug. There's very close monitoring of seroconverters to see if there's the emergence of drug resistance. Adverse events are monitored and managed. This study started in 2005. It took longer to enroll than intended. It was completed just 1 year ago, and with 2 years of follow-up, this study will be completed next year. It is, again, fully enrolled. The second CDC study is the Bangkok tenofovir study. Shown on this map are the BMA drug treatment clinics where injection drug users are enrolled. And I must say, having lived in Bangkok for a long time, Mexico City is the only place that makes Bangkok feel like a small town. These 17 drug treatment clinics where these IDUs enrolled were also the same clinics where the VaxGen HIV vaccine trial was conducted from 1999 to 2003. And this is a good example of research infrastructure being developed in the past being used for current studies. The BTS study is a phase 2-3 randomized trial. Now, going forward, many of these studies have the same elements. They're all randomized placebo-controlled trials, so I won't say that about each one, but I will point out the unique characteristics that make each study special and different. Now, this study population is HIV-negative drug users enrolled in treatment clinics aged 20 to 60. The original sample size for this study was 1,600. However, due to an observed lower HIV incidence than had been observed earlier, the sample size is now up to 2,400. All participants will be followed for 1 year after the completion of enrollment. Participants may choose to receive their drug with daily observed therapy. Many of them are on methadone maintenance or methadone treatment, and they come to the clinic daily, or they can come in monthly and get a 30-day supply of drug. As of last month, this study was 90% enrolled, and there's an event-driven review, so it's unclear exactly when we'll reach the endpoints of this trial. These objectives are similar for all the trials I'll be talking about. Really, the purpose here is to determine whether or not tenofovir prevents infection, is it safe, and then we'll evaluate risk behaviors, adherence, alteration, disease progression, and seroconverters, and an important issue, whether or not resistance develops in those that become infected on trial. The third CDC trial is the Botswana TDF2 trial being conducted in Habarone and Francistown. Again, a similar trial design to the Thai trial. This trial also started in 2005. However, initially it was a single agent. It was a tenofovir trial. But after the enrollment of a small number of participants, a decision was made to convert this from a tenofovir trial to a Truvada trial, thinking that 2 drugs were better than 1 based on the data from the macaque studies. So this was converted to be the TDF2 trial, started in February 2007. The original population was going to be 1,200 heterosexual men and women aged 18 to 29. But again, another challenge, the enrollment has been slower than expected to date. HIV incidence is lower than estimated. So the investigators are now planning to expand the age range to 39 and expand the sample size up to as high as 2,000 through the addition of an additional site or 2. The next study is the IPREX study, sponsored by NIH with support from the Gates Foundation and drugs donated by Gilead. This study is unique, and as an efficacy trial, it will enroll 3,000 high-risk MSM, randomized 1-to-1 daily oral PrEP PrEP or placebo, and the PrEP drug here is the 2-drug combination Truvada. The participants will be followed for these things here, which are similar for many of the studies, However, I will point out a couple of special things. Both of these drugs are nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors, which is also active against hepatitis B virus. So individuals that are hepatitis B surface antigen positive are at risk for having hepatitis B flares. That is, if you start drugs for hepatitis B treatment and then you stop the drugs, it's possible that people will get a resurgence of their hepatitis activity, and that's an important consideration that has to be monitored in these PrEP trials. Of course, people will be monitored for their adherence and if infected, viral load and immune characteristics and CD4 count, and importantly, drug resistance will be assessed. This map shows the IPREX studies. The PI is in the room with us, Bob Grant, currently enrolling in 2 sites in North America and 4 sites in Peru and Ecuador, and study sites in Brazil, Cape Town, and Chiang Mai are in the preparatory phase. Bob Grant was kindly updated the slides this week, and after 3 years of preparation, IPREX is enrolling as planned, and there are now more than 1,000 MSM enrolled in the IPREX study. Now, it should be obvious why MSM are important for the PrEP agenda. MSM bear a major burden of the epidemic, certainly in the Americas, in some parts of Asia, and there's a growing understanding of the burden that MSM play, that gay men play, or men who have sex with men play in the African epidemic as well. It's important to assess efficacy for rectal exposure. It's quite possible that due to the higher transmission efficiency of rectal transmission versus vaginal transmission, that the dynamics could be different, and that possible different tissue penetration of virus and drug will be an important thing to monitor. IPREX is the only efficacy trial of PrEP among MSM. The next trial is the Partner PrEP study. This is a study being conducted by Connie Callum and colleagues from the University of Washington. The unique characteristic here is this is a study being conducted in discordant couples, and it builds on the infrastructure built by Connie and her team for herpes simplex virus suppression studies. So this is a parallel comparison, a 3-arm study of tenofovir alone, Truvada combination, and placebo. Now, when one considers the widespread implementation of PrEP, HIV discordant couples would be a high priority group to focus on. Studies from Africa suggest that more than half of new HIV transmission events may occur in stable couples. This is a 3-arm trial comparing tenofovir, Truvada, and placebo. And the unique characteristics of enrolling couples in a study is not only will the HIV-negative individual who will be randomized in the study be enrolled, but their HIV-positive partners will also be enrolled in the study and followed longitudinally. So this will allow us to assess the efficacy of PrEP in those individuals that have high viral load and low viral load, thinking that the partners are likely the source of infection, but of course they may not be the source of infection in all cases. Drug levels of the study drug will be assessed in both the participant as well as the partner to assess whether or not the study participant who's on drug shares their antiretroviral, their study agent, with their partner. There will be an assessment of baseline resistant in the positive individual and longitudinal resistance to see if there's a change in that resistance pattern and to monitor whether or not there's transmitted or required resistance in the seroconverters. So couples really provide a great opportunity to learn a lot about HIV transmission and resistance. This is a study design. 8 sites in Kenya and Uganda will conduct this study. The 3,900 discordant couples, the HIV-positive partners will have a CD4 count greater than 250, so they will be not on antiretroviral treatment for their own disease. They'll be randomized to the 3 arms we talked about. They will receive best preventive services, and I would say also that's a common element in all of the prevention trials we're talking about. All of this, these trials will provide prevention services to the best of local standards, followed for 2 to 3 years, the endpoint of infection and safety. Now, with a sample size of 3,900 and the 3 arms, an estimation of incidence of just over 3% in the placebo arm, there's an estimation of 191 endpoints. This would give the study 80% power to detect 60% efficacy in each arm against placebo and to rule out an efficacy of less than 30%. The important thing here in the timeline for this study is that it has started. There are 2 sites have activated in Uganda just May and June, so this study is up and rolling now. The 6 additional sites expect to be activated by the end of 2008, and with target enrollment taking 2 years, we expect to have results from this study in 2011. There are 2 planned trials we'll talk about. FHI's FemPrep study, again, a randomized trial. The sponsor is FHI with funding from USAID and the Gates Foundation. 6 sites currently planned in South Africa, Malawi, Kenya, and Tanzania will enroll 3,900 women at high risk for HIV infection. A strong component of this trial is an integrated interdisciplinary approach. Lute van Dam is the PI of the clinical aspects of the study, and Amy Corneli is PI of the social, behavioral, and community aspects. And there's a great deal of effort going into understanding the socio-behavioral aspects of the individuals that will be enrolled and community engagement, both in preparatory and the ongoing conduct of the study. And the study will also have a pilot intervention development so that if the study product is effective, it will be possible to roll it out in a pilot phase programmatically. Again, the study drug here is Truvada versus placebo. People will be on drug for 52 weeks, and people who seroconvert will be followed for an additional 52 weeks. Similar objectives for FemPrep as the other trials, safety and efficacy. I will draw our attention to a couple of items here. Tenofovir has been associated with a decrease in bone density, so people are assessed for that potential adverse effect. And with 3,900 women in Africa being enrolled, the risk, there will be undoubtedly be a number of pregnancies. Now, to enroll in the study, women need to agree to and be on an effective mode of contraception. But as we know from previous PrEP trials, previous microbicide trials, and many prevention trials, pregnancy is a common outcome, and it's an important consideration here. And this study will no doubt give us a great deal of information on the incidence of pregnancy in these situations. We'll learn about adherence and behavior around the time of seroconversion as well, and monitor for risk disinhibition. The important things in the FemPrep timeline, the study was approved by FHI's Prevention of Human Subjects Committee in March of this year. The IND has been submitted. Training has started in Kenya last month. It's hoped that the first screening will take place in the fourth quarter of 2008, and if all goes well, the primary and secondary objectives will be reached in 2011 and 2012. The VOICE study wins the award for the prettiest picture of all the studies, and this is the vaginal and oral intervention to control the epidemic study that Slim talked a bit about, conducted by the Microbicides Trial Network with support from NIH. The objectives of this study are to determine whether or not tenofovir gel, 1%, oral tenofovir, or oral Truvada prevent HIV infection, and whether or not they're safe in women at risk for STD, sexually transmitted HIV. Slim has showed you this already, but just to go over that, women will be on product an average of 21 months with 840 in each of the five arms, oral Truvada, oral tenofovir, oral placebo, and tenofovir gel and placebo gel. So a very powerful design that will allow us to look at both a topical use of tenofovir and oral use of the agents. The hypothesis behind VOICE is that there's at least a 25% difference in effectiveness comparing each of the agents against placebo, tenofovir gel, tenofovir oral, and Truvada, and that there's no difference in safety. VOICE sites are ramping up in South Africa, Malawi, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. This is the timeline as of a couple of months ago. The study is going through approvals. IRB approvals are being obtained. Accrual will start either late this year or early 2009, and we expect completion in 2011 or 2012. So just in summary, these are the three CDC studies. The U.S. study will definitely be done in 2009. Thailand and Botswana are having problems with both accrual of clients and low incidence. So there's a question mark next to the 2009-2010 completion date of these studies. IPREX is up and running, 1,000 MSM enrolled in this study. We hope to have results in 2010. Partners PrEP is just getting started with discordant couples, a large study. Hopefully we'll have results in 2011. And the two planned studies will enroll more than 8,000 women in Africa into this clinical trial. And we hope if these studies go well, we'll have data on these products by 2012 as well. So when you put all these seven trials together, nearly 20,000 individuals will be randomized in these clinical trials, which will give us a very robust evaluation of tenofovir, Truvada, oral tenofovir, and gel tenofovir for 11,000 African women, 3,000 African men, 3,000 MSM from around the world, and 2,400 IDUs in Bangkok. So the next steps, it'll be important to understand if intermittent PrEP is feasible and effective. Taking the drug intermittently around the time when one might be exposed is probably more feasible for many people in the world. There will undoubtedly be new ARVs and new combination of ARVs, potentially new formulations in addition to oral and gels, potentially an injectable agent with a long half-life vaginal ring formulation. It will be important to understand how PrEP works for adolescents, and there's a myriad of programmatic implementation issues that are beginning to be worked on now, certainly at CDC and other normative bodies. So I'd like to end by acknowledging all the collaborators who were kind enough to share their slides, their wisdom. Special thanks to Mitch Warren and AVAC, who's done a great job in actually promoting the PrEP agenda and disseminating information. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks very much, Tim. If I can just remind everyone that if you have burning questions, you need to put your hand up and fill out your question card, and we'll do our best to try and address those questions given the time we have left. So I think at this point in the symposium, the audience is probably very clear that whether we give oral or topical PrEP, we have a number of problems, from identifying populations, enrolling them, keeping them on study, monitoring for safety. And to add to that logistical list, we should now probably add resistance. Will resistance occur in the setting of these studies? How are we going to measure it? How big a problem might it be or not? So to help us with this complex problem, I'm delighted to introduce one of my colleagues from the University of Pittsburgh, John Mellors, who's a professor of medicine and chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases. He's also the executive director of our HIV-AIDS program, the virology core for the MTN, the Microbicide Trial Network. And as we all know, his areas of expertise are in HIV infection, antiretroviral therapy, and particularly the issues surrounding drug resistance. So, John, tell us, should we be worried or not?
Well, all I can say, and I hope I can convince you by the end of 15 minutes or so, is that showing efficacy in a clinical trial is really just the first step in trying to achieve a public health benefit. I'd like to thank Ian and the organizers for giving me an incredibly challenging topic to cover in a short time. So first, let me dispense with the issue of oral versus topical PrEP. And in this context and in this talk, I'm talking about antiretroviral PrEP, the use of specific HIV inhibitors, for instance, the nucleoside analog RT inhibitors, or the NNRTIs that you've heard about. So in terms of topical, there's concerns that there's less systemic exposure but greater mucosal exposure. There's a sense, if I took a show of hands, that there would be less efficacy for a topical preparation, but I encourage you after this session to go see Waleed Hanani from CDC present a study done by Irvi Perek on tenofovir FTC gel, and I won't preempt Waleed's punchline, but the efficacy rivals that of anything given orally. Less toxicity and possibly less resistance. There's also a bias that there'd be less adherence, but who knows? We could get an added benefit. It could improve sex if it's the right formulation, and that might actually improve adherence. In terms of oral, there's certainly greater systemic, but it looks like less mucosal exposure. That might or might not translate into greater efficacy. Could result in greater toxicity and possibly more resistance. There's a bias, again, that there would be better adherence to one pill once a day, but not if it's less tolerable and we're getting systemic exposure to a drug. So I think it's fair to say that there is equipoise as to whether an oral or topical ARV PrEP will be better, and that's why we do clinical trials. And those of you in the audience who think you know the answer to this, please let us do the studies. So some key population issues. First, the effectiveness of PrEP, the percent protection, and will it be adhered to? Will there be sexual disinhibition, either on or off PrEP, in either susceptible or those who are already infected? Will there be erosion of other preventive strategies, such as migration away from condoms, or less motivation for circumcision? These are bona fide concerns. What about the toxicity of PrEP? We're really talking about a very high bar here. We're talking about giving indefinite therapy to healthy users, both male and female, who may be pregnant or breastfeeding. And there's a bit of dilemma here because the regulatory agencies are very reluctant to let us study these agents in pregnant or breastfeeding women. a huge concern is, will we be able to provide access to PrEP reaching at-risk groups, and the cost involved? And the cost is compounded by the need to monitor HIV serostatus before, during, and after HPV co-infection. You heard what Tim said about starting and stopping tenofovir, tenofovir FTC, and also monitoring for pregnancy. And finally, drug resistance and its impact on prevalence and antiretroviral therapy efficacy. This is the question I'm asked about most often. So how do we gain insight? Well, we ask for an expert opinion. The problem with that is everybody knows an expert and everybody has an opinion. And that usually doesn't lead to much insight. We generate data through clinical trials, but the major issue is the primary efficacy, the primary endpoint is efficacy, not effectiveness in the population. Population studies can be undertaken. These are difficult and costly. Both take time. You heard from Tim nicely the timeline for the various trials before we have data. So the current state is what I would describe as a data-free zone in human beings. So what to do? Well, mathematical and computational modeling can represent the dynamics of transmission and the impact of interventions. It can identify key drivers of outcomes rather than the actual outcome. And this is important for gearing up for public health intervention measures. You can do modeling much quicker than you can do any clinical trial. And you can do it while you're waiting for data. And once you get data, you can refine the model. The cautions are simple. Although complex in structure, models tend to oversimplify the human race. And garbage in, garbage out. If you have bad assumptions in your model, you're going to get a bad and unreliable output. So what I'd like to tell you about is two models, one on the population impact of PrEP and one on the impact of PrEP on resistance and vice versa. This was published in PLOS One last year by Ume Abbas and Roy Anderson. Roy looking very young and smart, and the same with Ume. I didn't show my picture for obvious reasons. And the methods were to use a dynamic mathematical model with coupled nonlinear differential equations, about 1,000, with numerical analysis through simulation, a model population stratified by age, gender, sexual activity, stage of HIV infection, whether they were on or off PrEP, and HIV drug susceptibility in a very crude way initially. The model parameters were chosen to simulate a mature HIV epidemic in sub-Saharan Africa. Sensitivity analyses standard were used to determine the relative influence of PrEP-related input parameters on prevention, and scenario analyses used to assess the differential potential impact of PrEP. And this just shows that the model simulates nicely an epidemic in its evolution compared with data on HIV prevalence in Zambia antenatal clinics. And I couldn't help to recognize it looked very similar to the data that Slim showed about the South African epidemic. So with a sensitivity analysis, we generate something called a partial rank correlation coefficient. It ranges between minus 1 and plus 1, 1 being the most efficacious for preventing new infections and minus 1 the most hindrance for preventing new infections. And four things popped out, but three very strongly. Obviously, no surprises here. The effectiveness of PrEP, the coverage of the population, and whether people discontinue it or not are the major drivers of the proportion of new infections that are prevented. So using that information, we derive different scenarios, both optimistic, neutral, and pessimistic, and different strategies, whether to target by activity, age, or just the general population. and examine the impact of sexual inhibition. And here are just the parameters for the optimistic, neutral, and pessimistic scenarios. I don't have time to go through each, but you get an idea, 90%, 60%, 30%, effectiveness, coverage, 75, 50, 25, and so forth. Time to ramping up, PrEP discontinuation rate, and increase in risk behavior. And with no sexual inhibition, the optimistic scenario, non-targeted, targeted by age or targeted by activity, shows 74, 45, and 28% reduction in cumulative new infections over 10 years, which in southern sub-Saharan Africa would translate into millions of infections prevented. With a neutral scenario, we see less effectiveness, and with a pessimistic, little. Now, the important thing here is that with 100% increase in sexual activity or disinhibition, we see very striking erosion of the neutral and pessimistic scenarios with less of an effect on the optimistic, largely driven by the high efficacy of PrEP in that scenario. So the conclusions from this initial work are PrEP could have a major public health impact. By targeting it to groups with the highest sexual activity, minimizing sexual disinhibition, and having a high effectiveness, and the best scenario would be 90%. I don't know if we will achieve that with the current agents. The benefits could be lost, though, by sexual disinhibition, high PrEP discontinuation, especially with lower PrEP effectiveness. And the key variables identified in this model will likely determine the actual impact of PrEP at the population level. So let me move on to the resistance model. You see Roy's a little bit older, and Ume looks a little more haggard, and I'll explain why. But first, some reasonable resistance assumptions. The reasonable assumptions are that an individual who is put on oral antiretroviral PrEP with undiagnosed HIV infection will develop resistance. I think that's a safe assumption from our studies of treatment-naive individuals. Resistance is likely to persist on PrEP, but will decline off PrEP quickly for some mutants. And with tenofovir and FTC, 65R and 184 are the major culprits, and there is data in treatment experience individuals that these decline rapidly because of a fitness effect on the reverse transcriptase. It's also reasonable to assume that individuals who become infected on antiretroviral PrEP will likely develop resistance unless the PrEP is stopped. Resistance will persist on PrEP and may decline more slowly off PrEP, particularly if no wild-type virus is transmitted. And this is a key unanswered question in the field. So the detailed drug resistance modeling we did involved 22 HIV drug susceptibility states, included both transmitted and acquired resistance, and modeled inadvertent PrEP use in previously infected individuals and in those who become infected on PrEP, and modeled variable persistence of resistance. And this is just a flow diagram of the new model structure. The modeling methods, analysis, and output were that it was a stratified model population that tracked over 5,000 different states. We used the standard sensitivity and scenario analyses, and the key model outputs were change in cumulative new infections and prevalence of drug resistance and incidence of transmitted resistance. I won't show you that in the interest of time. And out of a whole series of variables, the key drivers of prevalence of resistance, according to partial rank correlation coefficients, were coverage of the population. The more drug pressure, the more likely there is to be resistance. Persistence of acquired resistance, how long it persists in an individual that it's selected in. Increase in risk behavior, and the fraction that develop acquired resistance when inadvertently put on PrEP. Use effectiveness of PrEP, which is a function of efficacy times adherence, was a negative predictor of resistance. What is that telling us? That's telling that if you block infection, you don't get resistance. if you take the medicines and you have high use effectiveness, you don't get infection. And that translates into the mantra, no infection, no resistance. And we went through various scenarios. I don't have time again to describe the input parameters for the optimistic, neutral, or pessimistic scenarios. But one of the key factors is the PrEP discontinuation rate is very high, and the inadvertent PrEP use duration and the proportion with inadvertent PrEP use is very high in this kind of doomsday pessimistic scenario. And when we look first at the efficacy of PrEP without any drug resistance, so drug resistance can occur in this model, we see very similar results to what I showed you before. But strikingly, when we add in drug resistance, in the optimistic scenario, where there's less use of inadvertent PrEP, the efficacy or effectiveness of PrEP is not reduced in the optimistic scenario, but it's really tampered down to nil in the pessimistic and lowered significantly in the neutral scenario. And when we look at the prevalence of drug resistance by these different scenarios, and this does not include the complication of concomitant antiretroviral therapy in part of the population, we see this terrifying prevalence of resistance of close to 50% regardless of strategy in the pessimistic scenario, but in optimistic and neutral scenarios, modest prevalence. And when we do an analysis of the key parameters influencing prevalence of resistance by sensitivity interpretation, we see that the risk, and this is the proportion of that high level of resistance explained in the different scenarios, the rate of inadvertent PrEP use in users with pre-PrEP infection and the duration of that use are major contributors. The rate of emergence of acquired resistance is also a driver, and less so the duration of inadvertent PrEP use and emergence of resistance in those who developed infection on PrEP. So these are the top three. So in conclusion then, inadvertent ARV PrEP use will drive the population prevalence of drug resistance. The rate of its misuse and the duration are critical. Previously infected is probably more likely to drive high prevalence than those infected on PrEP, but that's a bit speculative. So as an early warning, PrEP rollout must include routine testing of recipient serostatus. If we don't and we give PrEP indiscriminately to those who are infected, we will have a much higher prevalence of resistance. PrEP effectiveness is still maintained at low resistance prevalence, and resistance from antiretroviral therapy is likely to reduce PrEP effectiveness and vice versa. We haven't modeled that yet. We'll all look very old by the time that model's ready to present. And overlap between PrEP and ART agents are obviously suboptimal because of cross-resistance, and I'd be happy to end and answer any questions. Thank you very much.
John, thanks very much for that comprehensive overview. We have a few minutes for questions, and so I'll try and field some with Namita. Perhaps we can begin with one interesting question from the audience, which I'll address to Dr. Vanham. This issue of how do we identify best-in-class to move into clinical testing, because as has been pointed out, in the absence of proof of concept of a drug ever working, how do we actually validate any of the assays? So how do we actually move forward in that context?
Yeah, well, there is only an empirical answer to that. That is to say that I showed you different various models, so I think you need to test the drugs or compare the drugs of the same class in various models. And I think it is especially important to look at cell-free and cell-associated, to compare activity against cell-free and cell-associated viruses. As long as we don't know whether cell-associated, and I mean there is a lot of evidence that cell-associated virus can be transmitted, you should make sure that your candidate is active against cell-associated virus.
Thank you. Another question which I'll address to Slim, just to be controversial. What about anal sex in your efficacy studies of gels? And Tim can maybe chip in if he wants to too, because clearly if you're assessing a vaginal product, you might protect the vagina, but you won't do much for the rectum. So how do you operationalize that?
Right from the initial microbicide gel studies that were undertaken, anal sex has always been quite an important issue in that the net effect of rectal anal sex is that it would reduce the likelihood of showing efficacy. So the strategies that have been undertaken is to look at your inclusion criteria and to focus your cohorts or your study participants mainly on those who are not engaging in anal sex. And for those who are, to have them go through counseling so that they reduce the amount of anal sex or avoid anal sex for the duration of the study period. I think the big issue is none of these products that have been tested have been through all the requisite safety procedures for us to recommend their use in the rectum. And so all of the vaginal gel studies that have been done on the basis that we would allow for a certain amount of anal sex to dampen the overall effect, and so that the sample size calculations that are done to show efficacy take that into account. By the way, the same issue applies to pregnancy. We anticipate that once any woman within a microbicide trial becomes pregnant, they have to go on to product hold, and so any infections that occur in pregnancy are occurring off product. And so the net effect of pregnancy is to dampen the effect and reduce the likelihood of showing a difference across the arms. And the way in which we deal with that is simply by increasing the sample size and trying to show an effect over and above that dampening effect of anal sex and pregnancy.
So now we're going to move to quick questions and even quicker answers. It's like Jeopardy. So, Namita?
Yeah. Several questions for Tim. What is going to happen with people that change their partners during the follow-up of the cohort of discordant couples in the PrEP studies?
Yeah,
a quick answer to that, Tim.
That's an excellent question. As I suggested in the study, enrolling the partners allows you to identify one potential source of infection in those that are HIV negative. Of course, there's other potential exposures for those individuals. I don't know if any of the investigators are in the room. I actually am not sure what the plan is for that study if partnerships change during the course of the study.
Quick question for John Mellors. This is a critical one, I think. What's going to be the optimal way in terms of frequency and technique to ensure that our population is remaining HIV negative? So some of the audience have asked, should we use antigen antibody tests? Should we use molecular techniques? How often should we use them?
I think a molecular test is not feasible because of cost and availability. I think it would be serotesting, and it would be screening with rapid tests as we do in our VCTs. The frequency of testing on PrEP is something that we need to think about. And it would require capacity building, and there's some feasibility issues. I think that, you know, in the luxury of a clinical trial environment, we're testing monthly. That's unrealistic for the general population.
This is a question for the whole panel, and it says that if we get a positive result from IPREX and other studies in MSM first, how important will it be to continue and complete the PrEP studies in women before bodies like the WHO and UNAIDS give guidelines on PrEP? Considering that, you know, MSMs and women are different populations with different modes of transmission, so how will the positive results from PrEP studies and MSM impact studies in women? on the PrEP studies in women?
I could take a try at that. That's a very important issue, and now that we will soon have six or seven ongoing clinical trials, the impact of the results from one clinical trial on the other clinical trials will take a lot of careful consideration. We did have the experience recently of the South African circumcision study showing clear efficacy there. There were two other ongoing studies in Kenya and Uganda, and there was a clear decision that one trial really wouldn't be compelling enough to have normative bodies make circumcision recommendations. So those two other studies were carried to completion. I think given the finding of efficacy in one mode of transmission, a similar process might go forward. I think you'd have to consult with a variety of experts in the area and determine whether or not you still have equipoise in the ongoing studies to continue a placebo arm in those. And I think that would be influenced by the degree of efficacy in the trial, issues related to adherence, and comparison of where the other trials are in their course. If a trial's very nearing the end, it's much easier to say, let's carry this trial to the end and see if this different mode of transmission is different.
Thank you, Tim. The next question was, what about pregnancy? And I think a number of speakers have alluded to this, so I'll maybe answer that one. You know, we can't, unfortunately, due to, you know, regulatory authorities' guidelines at the moment, continue exposure to drug for individuals who become pregnant on study. And so the approach we take generally in the networks is we optimize, you know, family planning, contraceptive advice, and try and ensure that women don't become pregnant, but if they do, they have to come off. However, the Microbicide Trial Network, at least, is beginning to start looking at safety in pregnant women of tenofovir. We've just started the study in the women who are about to have an elective cesarean section as a beginning to see whether or not we can't create a framework where we can dose through pregnancy, because this is a hugely vulnerable period in women's lives to the acquisition of HIV. But for the moment in trials, they have to come off drug.
This is also addressed to the panel, saying that cervical and seminal factors were mentioned as considerations of models to be used. But what do we know about menstrual factors? Are they about menstrual factors? Are they also being considered?
Well, I think it's more difficult to model that in vitro, at least.
Is the question perhaps asking whether menstrual fluid, blood, whatever, might inactivate the products, the microbicides? I guess we know that the polyanions, all sorts of things can impact efficacy. But I think with the antiretrovirals, I don't see that would be a problem.
No, in fact, most data indicate that antiretrovirals remain active no matter, you know, whether you add seminal plasma or you add something else. It's...
Okay, should we? I think in the interest of time, we're about a minute before 1:00, we should probably wrap up the session. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank our distinguished panel for some great presentations and some excellent questions. This story will continue, but thank you.